Today, stories of power, corruption, opportunity, and the hope that can come from unexpected places, like making slime on YouTube. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 19th of November. Glad to be with you today. We begin with a couple of stories about the power of, well, power. First, the auto industry, where Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn, one of the most powerful figures in the industry, has been arrested by Japanese prosecutors and accused of underreporting his income on financial statements. Ghosn is also the head of France's Renault, Mitsubishi, and he's chairman of the business alliance of all three automakers. Nissan's second in command and several industry analysts said his arrest shows that too much power had been concentrated in one person for too long. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
2 decades ago, Carlos Ghosn was the savior of Nissan.
He took a failing Nissan and he merged it with Renault, a French-Japanese marriage that no one thought would work. It may have taken a very strong figure to make that work.
Michelle Krebs is executive analyst with AutoTrader. Nissan flourished for a while, but has struggled recently.
I think much of this would not have come to a head had the company been extremely successful right now.
And that's the thing about concentrated power. When times are good, you don't hear as many complaints about it. Douglas Cha heads the Governance Center at the Conference Board.
Some people could say a very domineering CEO like a Steve Jobs, that ended up being good for that company, that without that, maybe they would not have moved so quickly and been willing to take so many risks.
And that is great if things work out. But generally speaking, when a corporate leader consolidates power, keeps directors on a short leash, appoints yes men or women, you don't tend to get great decision making.
It's very personality driven, and they don't have anyone there who's really challenging them.
Songhee Han, assistant professor at Penn State, analyzed thousands of companies' performances during crises and looked at the effect of having a more powerful leader.
The cost outweighed its benefit.
For innovative companies in competitive industries, she says, there's little room for error. An authoritarian CEO can raise a company up or drive it toward ruin. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Now for another story about a company with the power to move markets, like all of them. Shares of Apple took a hit today, falling almost 4%. Investors have not liked reports that Apple has cut production orders in recent weeks for all three of its iPhone models launched earlier this fall. And since Apple is one of the most widely owned stocks by individuals and institutions, any troubles in iPhone land have a big ripple effect. From KUT in Austin, Marketplace's Andy Euler checks in on the health of Apple's business.
Skylar Smith is a 19-year-old student at the University of Texas at Austin. She's got an iPhone, but she's not at all tempted to upgrade to the XS, the XS Max, or the XR. She likes her old iPhone 7 Plus just fine.
It's pretty awesome how it is. Like, why keep upgrading it?
Another reason she's not upgrading, she finds the Face ID technology kind of creepy. Falling demand for the latest iPhones is forcing the company to cut back on the number it's making and the parts it's ordering. So if you're a company like Screenmaker Japan Display or British chipmaker IQE that supplies screens and chips for the iPhones, you're going to feel it when Apple says it doesn't need as many as it thought. Sylvie Jablonski with Direction Investments says that means suppliers, companies that make chips, for example, need to account for falling iPhone demand.
They probably do have to consider growth and diversification in AI and autonomous vehicles, you know, and the growth of data centers. I definitely think they'll have to rely on revenue from other things.
It's not just iPhone suppliers feeling the effects of Apple's recent woes. Tech stocks often move as a group. When a company as big and influential as Apple runs into trouble, the market becomes full of uncertainty.
But I just don't think that it's that clean of a relationship, that Apple is the market and the market is Apple.
Michael Batnick with Ritholtz Wealth Management.
I just don't think that you could say if Apple does this and the market will do that.
He says the market should chill out because stocks like Apple go up and stocks like Apple go down. Apple did not respond to a request for comment. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Here in the San Francisco Bay Area, air quality has been in the unhealthy to toxic range for over a week because of the deadly wildfires in the northern part of the state. This level of air pollution is a daily reality to many people around the world. And a new study from the University of Chicago says air pollution, specifically the kind caused by burning fossil fuels, is directly tied to shorter lives, 2 years shorter for the average person in the world, in fact. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has more.
There are many ways to assess the risk of tiny air particle pollutants known as PM2.5. They've been linked in past studies to heart attacks and 4 million premature deaths every year. But how much they shorten a person's life? That could be the best metric, says economist Michael Greenstone at the University of Chicago. He co-authored this study.
Particulate air pollution is the greatest threat to human life on the planet. It has a larger impact on life expectancy than AIDS, than even cigarette smoking,
than car crashes and terrorism. This microscopic pollutant is 3% the diameter of a human hair and works its way into the lungs and bloodstream. It comes mostly from burning gas in cars and coal in power plants. Jeff Holmsted, a former air regulator, has represented coal and power plant companies at the lobbying firm Bracewell.
It's pretty dramatic. I think it makes it much more valuable to policymakers. And of course, this is particularly important in places like China and India.
A Chinese life is shortened by about 3 years, says the study. In India, about 4. The average American life is only about 1 month shorter, thanks to the 1970 Clean Air Act, the paper says. But Janet McCabe at the University of Indiana Law School fears a rollback of rules in this administration.
There are voices out there saying our air is clean enough, so ongoing scientific research and developments are important. This ought to be part of that mix.
The Trump administration plans to revise rules on PM2.5 pollution in 2 years. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Apple kept on tanking, and so did everything else. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, I know it's Thanksgiving week, and a lot of us have a bunch of recipes scattered around for menu planning. But for the rest of the week, a lot of us are getting dinner delivered. In fact, this is becoming the new normal for dinner. Investment bank UBS reports that food delivery overall, including apps for ordering dinner, is turning into a $35 billion industry that is likely to grow to $365 billion by 2030. And the online delivery model, where you press a button and get food from anywhere, is changing how we eat and how restaurants have to operate. From KQED in San Francisco, Sam Harnett reports.
These days, a restaurant like Tacolicious in San Francisco's Mission District can be really busy, but look really slow.
Nobody has any clue what's actually going on here.
Joe Hargrave Cohn's Tacolicious. He says the number of lunch customers is down 35% this year, but lunch revenue is up 8%. That's because more of his tacos and tortas are being eaten off-site. As we talk on a recent day around lunchtime, online orders spit out of the ticket machine.
Online order, 10 tacos, 10 tacos.
Hargrave says his restaurant can't afford to ignore these apps. They bring business, but they also bring a whole lot of organizational challenges, says Hargrave's co-owner and wife, Sarah DeZarin.
Where will we store the compostable trays? Like, how will that torta travel? You know, how far can it go before it's dead? So it's almost like you're running an entirely different business on top of your business.
The apps have changed all sorts of things about the restaurant. For instance, the app Caviar said its customers wanted food in bowls. So now, Tacolicious serves food in bowls. It also plans to hire someone just to manage all the delivery orders.
As long as we will be delivering food, which it's, I don't see that ever ending, then we have to adapt every single thing we do.
The basic paradigm of what constitutes a restaurant in America is being redefined.
Hudson Reilly is a researcher at the National Restaurant Association.
The majority, 63% of all restaurant traffic now is off-premises.
That includes delivery, takeout, drive-thrus, and food trucks. Uber Eats, a delivery app, is encouraging restaurant owners to go even further, to create new restaurants where customers can only order online.
So we started experimenting with virtual restaurants in Chicago in the beginning of 2017.
Elise Propis is with Uber Eats.
The original concept we tested was poke because we saw that a lot of customers were searching for poke in the Uber Eats app, but they weren't always able to find it.
Uber Eats says it's been approaching restaurant owners to offer advice on how to start a virtual restaurant. The company says there are now more than 1,000 of these businesses serving all sorts of stuff.
Chicken wings, burgers, Mexican food, breakfast and brunch, salad, etc.
But what does the business model of third-party delivery do for restaurant profits, where margins are notoriously small? Sarah DeZarin and Joe Hargrave say delivery apps can take as much as a 30% cut from each order.
These are the prices that we're getting while they're building. But what's going to happen when they start killing each other off and one reigns supreme and they actually need to make a profit?
Hargrave and DeZarin own 5 restaurants, which has helped them negotiate a lower rate with the delivery apps. Smaller mom-and-pop restaurants don't have that leverage, so some opt not to use the apps. At Zocalicious, Hargrave's big worry is that he'll have to compromise his food for delivery. Do something like add preservatives to his tortillas to make them travel better. He says they've actually taste-tested their food after 20 minutes in a delivery car.
I didn't do this to put food into boxes. I like food, but I like giving food to people and seeing them interact with it.
That, Hargrave says, is why he wanted to open a restaurant in the first place. I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
In this country, education is supposed to equal employment, or at least employment opportunities. And while this can be true for individuals, education alone can't necessarily lift up an entire community. The Blackfeet Reservation in Montana is one such community. It's a place where the people who live on the reservation are increasingly going off to receive college degrees. But trying to bring their new skills home isn't easy. Sterling Holy White Mountain grew up on the Blackfeet Reservation in Browning, Montana. He wrote about this for The Atlantic. Sterling, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So the title of your piece in The Atlantic is Blackfeet Brain Drain. What are you referring to? Tell us about that.
Well, one, I didn't choose the title. That was something that I found out, you know, in the writing process is that, like, when you write for somebody like The Atlantic, you don't really have a say in the title, which, you know, was fine. But that was their interpretation of, like, what the heart of the article was.
Do you agree?
I do. I think for me personally, like, that's what the article was about. I've been around Indian country a lot, and I know a lot of people who are from other reservations. And when I talk to them about this type of stuff, they nod their heads. Like, this is something that's taking place across Indian country in the United States.
What's so interesting is that we always hear this narrative that education is the key to rebuilding communities, whether it's on reservations or even, you know, across rural America. And your piece seems to really be saying, no, that's not enough.
It's very much like the fish in water thing, where, like, fish don't know they're in water because that's all they've ever been in, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you grow up in Indian country, this narrative about what education is for, that's just what you grow up with. When I was a kid, I would still hear people say it this way. And what they would say is, like, you need to learn the white man's way so that you can come back and help this place, you know, exist and function in this world the way it works now. Mm. Now, that's not the narrative anymore, but that's still the subtext in a way of, like, you know, of education, is that this is what you're supposed to do. But my class was one of the first classes from Browning where a lot of people went off to college, and I can hardly think of a single one that's actually back on the reservation at this point.
In your article, it seems like you're saying that one reason it doesn't work is because there's not an economic infrastructure to support these educated people who come back.
Yes. It's not that there's no white collar jobs. Like, I had one of them. It was working at Blackfeet Community College. But there's not what you could call a white collar economy. And I'm not sure that I've ever been to a reservation where I could say, like, this place clearly has that level of economy.
Are you living on the reservation now? I know you went off and you got all this education and you have tried valiantly to make a living on the reservation. And are you still there?
I'm in Northern California for the next 2 years because I got a Stegner Fellowship at Stanford. I'll be writing on Stanford's dollar for the next 2 years. Thank you very much, Stanford. but it's still the other part of that article that's sort of purely personal, I guess, or, like, not something that you could apply across the board, is that because I am, you know, unfortunately a writer of fiction, it's very hard to figure out how to do that and make money at the same time. And so even when I'm done at Stanford, because that it's not a degree and it doesn't guarantee you any sort of future employment or income, I'm still going to be in a position where like I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do when I get out.
And you feel like that support, as you've written about, might not be there?
It's, I mean, it in all likelihood, the situation I'll be going back to will be the same one that I left. I think this is one of those things, this is one of those places where I think it's very hard for, we'll say, you know, regular Americans to understand, like, not very many Americans grow up in a place where there is almost no economy to speak of. It's very difficult to understand, like, how much of your sense of how the world should be has been determined by the fact that you grew up in a place where you lived in a functional economy. Now, if you don't live in a place like that, it becomes very difficult to figure out what these larger narratives, these larger cultural narratives are really for. When I would ask my students about, like, why do you guys want to go to school? Like, why are you getting your associate's degree? And a lot of them said, well, they want to go on and go to school somewhere else, you know, say at the University of Montana or Montana State University. And then I would say, well, what are you going to do after that? And that was the moment where they hit their wall of understanding, because there is no narrative with any kind of detail in Indian country about what you're supposed to do with that education. There's no discussion of that.
Sterling Holy White Mountain wrote about this in The Atlantic. Thanks so much for coming on, Sterling.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Coming up.
So my mom's always making fun of me, saying, like, you bought this house with slime.
With enough slime, amazing things can happen. But first, let's do the numbers. That's right. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was off 395 points, 1.5% to close at 25,017. This is like the saddest music I've ever had on the show. The NASDAQ fell 219 points, 3% to end at 7028, and the S&P 500 shed 45 points, 1.2% to finish at 2690. Automaker Nissan, we told you about them earlier, slowed 1%, only 1%, after the arrest of company chairman Carlos Ghosn on charges of underreporting his earnings and other significant misconduct. Nissan's partner firm Renault dropped 8.4% on the Paris market. Tech firms struggled as well. Bond prices fell. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Our next two stories are about people and their interesting jobs, because some of us actually do end up getting to do our dream jobs. We're taking a look at some of those people in our occasional series, How to Be a Blank. We'll be hearing from people with pretty cool jobs all week, and we're kicking things off with someone whose job it is to turn diamonds and gold into something even more valuable. Polly Wales is the director, founder, and designer at Polly Wales Fine Jewelry.
I did a degree and then I did a master's at the Royal College of Art. You're with other artists and designers for that 2-year intensive period, and everybody is just geeking out on whatever it is that they love. Prior to training as a jeweler, I had studied sculpture. I felt like it wasn't a very direct way to communicate with people. And one of the things that I love about jewelry is that mostly jewellery is given as tokens of love or commemorations. So, you know, it has a sort of much more immediate connection with people. I know a lot of designers who design collections, find, you know, manufacturers, put their vision on paper and have those pieces produced, and they make some really, really amazing work. That's not an avenue that I sort of know very much about, because I went to college and got the training to do it. And I think that's really sort of the way to go about it. Set up a little bench somewhere, get yourself some lessons, keep going, and try to do something that feels true to you and different from other people. Tenacity and commitment and passion, you know, I think are really important. And attention to detail and and patience. You know, the way that I've gone about building my business was not by designing a collection and getting a backer and getting some money and getting somebody else to make it, you know. Every single piece that I made then funded the next piece that I made until it grew and grew and grew. I'm at the bench about 3 days a week and I love it. It's just a very direct, meditative way of working. And that's what I've always loved doing, you know, and it really is idiosyncratic. So every time you try to make a piece, you look at it and it's never going to be the same as another one. And then once it's gone into the cast and it comes out in gold, we all kind of gather around the middle table and look at it and ooh and ah, and it's like Christmas Day.
You can see some of Polly's work and tell us about some dream jobs you'd like to hear more about at marketplace.org. Next up, turns out you don't actually need diamonds and gold to make something valuable. You might just need borax or toothpaste or food coloring. That's right, I'm talking about slime, the do-it-yourself craft that became a YouTube sensation. And if your children are into it, say thank you to Karina Garcia, the 24-year-old YouTuber who started her first slime crafting channel in 2015. Now she's got 7 million plus subscribers, a line of at-home craft kits under the Craft City brand at Target, and she told CNBC that her business makes about $2 million a year. I talked to her about the challenges of making a business around such a niche hobby and what was going through her mind when she first started.
I remember thinking in the back of my head, I was like, wow, this would be really cool if I could like not work anymore. But I never in a million years thought it would become my actual career. And it's so funny because slime is a big part of my life. So my mom's always making fun of me saying like, you bought this house with slime. And it's just like so funny, but it's really cool at the same time because it's slime. It's so random, you know?
Well, and it's so interesting because I feel like that's, you know, that's like the promise of this idea of this kind of creator economy. In some ways, there is a path, you know, everybody understands like talent manager, that's a thing. But understanding how to translate this very specific thing that creators and influencers do into merchandise and business agreements. Like, what were some of the biggest things that you encountered that you didn't know how to deal with, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely really hard. I mean, like, when you come out with a product as a YouTuber or as an influencer, people are ready to rip you apart, even if your product is amazing. I've learned that 100%. And also, making a product is so much harder than I thought it would be because, I mean, you know, we had to find manufacturers and everything. And I need to, you know, figure out measurements, figure out everything, and put that all into a box. Just the making of the product as well. For example, slime. You know, I make it at home all the time and I would say like, oh, it's totally safe and stuff. But homemade slime wouldn't be considered like, it wouldn't pass everything. So it's just a lot of work.
So what's your advice to people who are going to look to your success about being optimistic and working hard, but also being realistic?
We got to be real. In the back of your mind, you are thinking like, hey, this would be amazing if one day like I made money. But don't sit there and think like, I'm going to do this strictly because I need to make some money. You have to genuinely love it. I was doing crafting before YouTube and I saw my sister doing it and I honestly was so inspired by her. It looked so much fun. And since I was doing it already, I was like, hey, might as well just share it with everybody. But definitely be very patient. You're not going to start making money right away, you know. And if you do become successful when it comes to, you know, you coming out with like merchandise and stuff, find someone who has the same vision as you, who understands your brand 100%. Make sure that you trust them. And yeah, just make sure you're both on the same page.
Because, you know, trends move fast. And what if slime isn't cool tomorrow? Are you working on new products, new ideas?
Oh, yeah. It's still a thing, but I know that one day, you know, it can die and it likely will. I do different type of videos and I'm starting to get into different content and then crafting in general. Slime is a big part of it, but my craft line, it's all types of crafting for kids to get out there and get their hands dirty and just make different types of crafting. So it's not all dedicated to slime. So I'm happy that I decided to do just a crafting line in general. It just happens to be a big part of it.
Karina Garcia, 24 years old. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you so much.
This final note before we go is about a figure with the power to change a whole industry, because I do love a theme. Taylor Swift is getting a new music label. She just signed with Republic Records and Universal Music Group, and other musicians might be happy to have her on board. Swift has often pushed streaming music services like Apple Music and Spotify to pay artists more. She says she got UMG to agree that if it sells any shares in Spotify, which is, of course, publicly traded now, it will pay a higher share of those proceeds back to its other artists. All right, we got to go. You heard the sad music. The Dow Jones Industrial Average off 395 points, the NASDAQ down 219, and the S&P 500 shed just 45 points. It was nothing. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.